The following is intended for bizarre audiences only. Welcome to the Midnight Library.
Madam, the Count has returned from a drink in the village. Do you think he'll take tea with us?
Well, I thought you'd know, Mr. Darling. Do vampires even drink tea?
We are brothers of the Fang, madam. But he's a vampire, a blood connoisseur. I'm more of a lupine, compulsive carnivore.
Well, let's all have blood tea and see if that entices him.
What does drinking blood tea make you, madam?
Well, I'm a vampire adjacent.
Excelsior, madam.
Aw, here you all are. Well, most of you. Returning to hear the partner piece reading on vampires and blood-drinking cults. How wonderful to see that bloodlust is alive and well and hungrily coursing through the pulsing veins of our village's prey. Public. I am your hot-blooded host, Miranda Merrick. You'll notice that we've gone all out for your listening pleasure tonight. The reading room has been splashed with blood, red decorations, blood curtains, blood pillows, a new bloody slanket. I have donned a crimson gown, and a handsome Mr. Darling has bedecked his top hat with a blood red ribbon that's still damp from the dye, and dripping just a bit. Not to worry, the wolf pups will lap that right up. On the hospitality tray tonight, there's blood tea, blood clot cookies and biscuits, and sliced blood oranges. All pretend, of course, except for the blood oranges. The rest is all, made with red dye number 27 or 66 or something. Probably made from filthy little crushed up beetle bugs or something wholesome like that. I'm trying to deny that we're not trying to lure, entice, acclimate, initiate, or indoctrinate anyone into developing a taste for blood. No matter what you may have heard in the village. Which reminds me to remind you to stay well within the cordoned off areas of the library this evening, so that you don't disturb our special guest, and he doesn't disturb you. Now, as I'm sure you recall, when last we met, we heard all about how the divinely talented writer Bram Stoker was blessed with just the right happenings in his life to enable him to conjure up one of the world's most beloved characters, Dracula. Well, tonight, we're going to delve into the delectable topic of vampires, their history, and how they came about in the many cultures that have been fortunate enough to have them. Then we'll have a tantalizing tale or two about blood-drinking cults. The word cult, I'm sure you know, carries with it a negative connotation. But in reality, it is related to the root word culture, and simply denotes people who venerate, partake, worship, or are proponents of a given place or practice or religion. Well, by this definition, we could all assert that we are in the Midnight Library cult. But I don't suppose that would go over very well with everyone. Alternatively, I suppose I should note that the word cult is also related to the word occult, which encompasses all things mystical, magical, and supernaturally secret. And stop talking about it now. Let's switch to blood. That wonderful life-sustaining substance found in each of us and most creatures in some form or another, the world over. Blood has been the focus of rituals, lore, and beliefs since prehistory. One can easily imagine that when prehistoric people discovered that they themselves were pulsing with the stuff, or it spilled out of them, the first thing they likely thought was, "Oh, we need to do something about this. Let's put some handprints on a cave wall." Blood is so compelling because it is essential and beautiful. When fully oxygenated, it is bright red, and it has a shine that catches the light, even twinkling in the right light. When the tiny cells have delivered their load of oxygen to all the other cells in your body, and the blood darkens to a deep maroon, it is still equally as beautiful, if not more so, and enticing. To some, anyway. The intriguing word vampire seems to have arisen from a few homelands. It has veins that can be traced to Turkey, Hungary, France, and Germany, but seems to be firmly anchored in Serbia. The earlier pronunciation was likely more akin to vampire or vampire, later becoming vampire. The ancient Turkish definition, believe it or not, equates to witch. And while our brilliant Mr. Stoker wrote and gave us the first world-beloved vampire, Dracula, in 1897, before him there were the literary works of Lafano's Carmilla, published in 1872, and Pilidori's The Vampire, published way back in 1819. However, if we're going to talk about real beings, the origin of some of the very first publicized blood-drinking beings, well, there seems to be a veritable feast for our consumption. Without going too far back into hazy Greek myths, I've selected a few relatively modern vampires I'm happy to tell you about. I do believe it is important to note here that the image of vampires as we imagine them or know of them to be today, as suave, sexy, and sophisticated creatures, is in direct opposition from how they were known when they were believed to be real. These beings were the cursed, the undead, an animated corpse powered by a now damned soul, driven to harass, haunt, molest, or even feast upon the living in a never-ending hunt for their vital sustenance. So, yes, a bit different from the velvet vampires we're all so very fond of. One of the first persons believed to have become a vampire, which in this bit of lore wasn't so much about biting for blood, but more about being just miserably undead, was Jorge Grando from the charming old world village of Krinka in Croatia. When Jure Grando died in 1656, he was dolefully mourned and buried in the local churchyard like anyone else. But for some reason, he never fully rested or decomposed. His spirit was seen by several villagers who attested that they saw him wandering about with a dead sheep carried upon one of his shoulders and a black cat slung over the other. His own wife confessed that he had visited her in the flesh in the night, terrifying her in more ways than one. Other people in the town reported seeing him in the flesh too, wearing a demented grin across his face. He even appeared to the minister who had buried him, prompting the priest to dig up Jure Grando from his resting place. He was found in his coffin, as pristinely preserved as the day he was buried, 16 years earlier. Grando, still grinning in his casket, didn't seem to respond to any of the following: being shown a crucifix, several attempts to stab him with a hawthorn stake, or even a stern lecture from the priest who buried him. So, one brave villager came forward with an axe and neatly parted Grando's head from his shoulders, which ended his after-death antics, returning the village to its peaceful state. I'm pleased for his wife. Next, I have selected for you the continuing tale of Sava Savanovic, which began in Serbian stories going back to the 1700s. I say continuing because as recently as 2012, the town council of Ziroje issued a public health warning, informing and warning the local residents that there was the possible danger of Sava Savanovic, a known vampire, being on the hunt for fresh victims and housing. Long ago, Savanovic lived inside a remote mill and was said to viciously attack, bite, and drink the blood of men who came to mill their grain. Even after his death, people refused to use the mill, and it was abandoned. Rumors that the mill was haunted by Savanovic survived into modern times, when, in 2012, the old mill building he lived in collapsed, and it was believed that his blood-ravenous spirit would awaken, hungry and homeless, and that he would be seeking both food and shelter soon. Curiously, either seriously or perhaps for old time's sake, the sale of garlic and the making of wooden stakes and crosses both increased in the historic old town at the time. One very odd and unique characteristic of the vampire Savanovic? It was believed that he could transform into a butterfly. Oh, how sweet. From the same era and Serbian location, we have the satisfying story of the supposed true-life vampire, Peter Blagojevich, who died, well, sort of, in the year 1725. Soon after his death, nine other villagers were said to have died under mysterious circumstances, which is my favorite of all the circumstances. Other villagers, on their deathbeds, madly told their loved ones of how the ghoul Blagojevic sprang upon them in the night, terrorizing them and inching them towards death. The ghoul's own son was rumored to have ended up dead when his undead father returned to his home demanding food. When his frightened son recoiled and refused, Blagojevich ripped the boy apart and drank his blood. This distasteful happening, of course, incensed the local priest and villagers to disinter the buried body of Peter Blagojevich, who was found, as many others, in fine condition with a little fresh blood trickling from his apparently living mouth. He was immediately run through with a huge wooden stake, which pinned him forever to his resting place, we believe. Which, by the way, if you're seeking a restful place. Tonight's reading at the Midnight Library is proudly brought to you by Grimm's Grocers. If you happen to be a certain kind of a damned and cursed breed, Grimm's has what you have in mind. Grimm's carries just what you need. Flash your fangs in the Burgundy section in the aisle of imported fine wines. You'll be escorted in the right direction for samples from vintage bloodlines. Grimm's Grocers has blood from long before, all bottled and labeled by type. From donors from France to Singapore, whose veins were impeccably ripe. There's an endless array for you to discover, from fresh blood to classic antique. Tip back the blood of a hot Latin lover and put the color back into your cheeks. Perhaps you're craving German Type O to wash down your sour Braten. Or Type A Italian in your cappuccino. Grimm's has the best to be gotten. If you're a choosy vampire on the loose, visit Grimm's Cosmopolitan Plasma Isle, where you'll find imported blood-infused food and drinks from around the world. This week, try Boris's boiled blood from Borneo. It's guaranteed to have some sort of effect. All customers must sign a waiver and agree to only consume Boris's boiled blood at least 20 miles from the village. Grimm's Grocers at the corner of Vincent and Price. Now, although it is fun for me to inform you that thousands of old graves have been discovered all over the world in which the occupants have been found, hindered from any attempts to take part in vampirism, the bodies of the dead have been found dismembered and decapitated, stabbed with stakes and crucifixes. Some have had their jaws wedged open with giant bricks, while others have been squashed under slabs of immovable stone. I am also compelled to tell you the most likely reason the living have been subjecting the dead to this kind of harsh treatment for so long. Hundreds of years ago, when people, for some reason, were having visions or, who knows, perhaps actual ghostly sightings of their dearly deceased, they decided, as you've heard, to dig them up, to check on them. Well, they almost invariably found a slightly puffy in places corpse, often with blood coming from its mouth, or sometimes the eyes and nose as well. Without the process of embalming, a dead body will swell from filling with gases released from inside from the breakdown of the tissues. This gives the impression that the person has been eating or drinking blood. The living often reported that the hair and nails of their departed were longer and had obviously been growing after their death. This is due to the delicate tissues of the scalp and nails contracting and receding, which causes the typically hidden roots of the hair and nail beds to become visible, giving them the chilling appearance of having grown after burial. And those horrid grins we heard about? The drawing back of the thin skin of the face would also expose the teeth of the deceased, with the receding gums making the corpse look as though it's baring its elongated teeth. And the blood around their mouths, they saw? The blood was released from the decomposing organs and cells that had been forced up into the mouth by the pressure of the expanding gases in the abdomen. See how nicely it all works? So, based on their limited understanding, they did what they believed would put their cursed loved ones to rest and protect and give peace to the living. They disabled the dead. Chillingly, there is substantial evidence of prehistoric peoples, people with no written language, sacrificing their animals and children. We know not for certain to whom or what. We can venture a guess that when early humans began killing and eating animals, that they left nothing to waste. That every part of the animal, including its blood, was consumed. Many cultures today still abide by this philosophy of waste not, want not. Long ago, on my father's side, there was an uncle who raised hogs who claimed that they were going to make use of, and I quote, everything but the whistle. It would be disrespectful to the animal not to. But all of this ancient mysticism surrounding the power of blood is something that's been with humanity since early times when rituals and blood sacrifices were the primary way to communicate with the gods. If you were willing to slaughter a living animal or person, well, apparently this showed the god how serious you were. Sacrifices were also made in the interest of fertility and ancestor worship. Nearly all written records from the earliest cultures mention sacrifices of one kind or another being made to the gods. The Greek, Egyptian, Mesopotamian, and Mayans are just a few of the old world cultures known to have recorded writings or pictographs that document rituals featuring blood. It seems, somehow, only natural that people would have the idea to drink it, perhaps believing it would grant them strength, wisdom, or supernatural powers. The ability to commune with sacred deities or divine devils, one might guess. Which reminds me, in regards to tonight's other sponsor, I should like to make the following retort to address the rumor that we in the Midnight Library are, vampire sympathizers. That rumor is pure speculation, gossip, and hearsay. We are, however, proud to offer anyone who may need, for any reason, the services of the League of Lady Gravediggers. If you happen to be in possession of a body that's drained of its blood, we know some girls by profession who will hide it way down in the mud. Once you've had your transfusion and your friend has gone stiff with rigor, get the girls who are into collusion. Call the League of Lady Gravediggers. When your donor's about to expire and their carcass is in need of reaping, they don't care if you're a vampire. They just want that corpse for safekeeping. The ladies will dig a nice crater, 'cause the flesh and the bones are still good. We might not want them later, but we might know a werewolf who would. If you are able to go out in daylight, you can meet the ladies in person any Saturday in Possum Park. Approach the League of Lady Gravediggers without fear. Those are, bats and shovels they're carrying, not wooden stakes. Or call from the comfort of your casket for courteous quick pickup and no questions asked service for cadaver removal without approval. Call 976-DITCH-WITCHES. Now, as you may have heard, as we have, that there are among us some who currently partake of hematological refreshments. Well, we care not to confirm nor deny or endorse such dangerous dalliances, but I will tell you that a ruffled little book on our shelves does expound on an ancient blood-drinking festival that's held high in the misty mountains of the Himalayas in the country of Nepal. And those that have their blood drunk don't really care that much, and afterwards they tend to wander off to chew on some weeds. Well, what on earth is going on here? Well, the blood drinkers are Nepali villagers participating in an age-old custom of drinking fresh from the vein hot blood of the drinkees, who happen to be enormous yaks. The yaks, which are giant furry cattle, are regarded as rather sacred animals. They graze upon potent plants and herbs that are believed to have healing powers, but these plants are too dangerous for humans to consume directly. The yak blood is believed to carry healthful and healing properties provided by the forbidden foliage. So each year, many Nepali villagers trek high into the mountains to camp and to take a warm nip of bovine blood direct from the neck of a yummy old yak. This next delicious little tale I have for you, though, is the genuine bloody thing. It goes without saying that nearly all of the world's religions hold blood in high esteem. With many references to the fluid iron substance spilling, flowing, glowing, and being generally oh so sacred. And I'm sure you know that many of the world's cultures are fortified with the blood of martyrs and saints. So it may surprise you to hear that one martyred saint's blood was in high demand, after his death, of course, because people were mad to drink it. The much-murdered and superstar saint is Thomas Becket. A man with such a dramatic and climactic life and death story that we might well have dedicated an entire reading to him. That is, if we were more enamored with saints around here. Anyway, although there is much veneration of blood within the Catholic faith, the drinking of it has always been restricted to the imbibing of blood in a strictly symbolic fashion only, with the holy blood being represented by and substituted with wine. Sacramental wine, to be exact. So why the change of heart regarding the blood of Thomas Becket 850 years ago? Why was his blood the exception? Well, let me begin by saying that Becket was an enigmatic, contentious character who was both cherished and reviled during and after his lifetime. He began life as a low-born commoner who swiftly rose through the ranks, first becoming King Henry II's chancellor, or debt and tax collector. Then he was made Archbishop of Canterbury. It was believed by the king that bestowing upon Becket this lofty church title, that he would continue being a kind of wealth henchman for the king, and now having access to the church's funds, well, you get the idea. But Thomas Becket was said to have become a different man when he became indoctrinated into the powerful post in the Catholic Church. Becket became introspective and then pious. He rejected the former lavish lifestyle he enjoyed and ensured for King Henry, and turned his heart toward God and the people he had once taken advantage of for the king. Soon, the two mighty men representing the church and the country were fiercely against one another. They fought over money, power, and the court system, which members of the church could not be tried in, no matter how heinous their crimes might be. This meant that the king couldn't control, jail, or execute Becket's friends or fellow church members. When King Henry's son was crowned junior king, Becket was excluded from the ritual of the boy's crowning, which was attended by several bishops and other members of the church. This snubbing offended Archbishop Becket so much that he ordered the bishops who sanctioned the crowning of the boy king to be excommunicated, or basically expelled from the Holy Church. It was this power play that supposedly caused King Henry II to utter within earshot of his knights the history-changing line,
"Will no one rid me of this meddlesome priest?"
Four incensed knights then took up their weapons, rode to Canterbury Cathedral, and demanded that Thomas Becket vacate the holy site. To which Becket basically replied,
"Yeah, make me."
And make him they did. The quad of knights burst into the sacred sanctuary and brutally attacked and murdered Becket in front of many witnesses. Explicit writings and depictions of the savage murder described and portrayed the four knights stabbing and hacking into Becket's head, sending spurting blood and bits of his skull flying through the air and landing upon the floor of the Holy Cathedral. It was said that the attending monks caught and sopped up Becket's blood, and even the fragments of his skull and bits of his brain, saving them in a large basin. But it is what happened immediately following the gruesome slaughter of the man that could not be ignored. As the faithful townspeople visited the bloody cathedral and the crypt of Thomas Becket, miracles began happening. And not just a few coincidental miracles, 703 documented miracles to be exact. The blind saw, the deaf heard, the paralyzed moved, the mad went sane, and people with leprosy stopped having leprosy. A castrated man's appendage was said to have grown back. The sick were healed over and over again. The miracles were all attributed to being in the presence of Becket's blood. Some dipped their fingers in it. Some dipped a piece of their clothing or cloth in it. Some drank it. One man was said to have taken a fragment of blood-dipped cloth home to his ill wife, where he then dunked the blood-stained cloth into a cup of water and gave it to her to drink. Whatever her ailment was, it completely disappeared. Throngs of people began making pilgrimages to Canterbury in hopes of drinking Becket's blood. And while it is true that there was reported to be a huge amount of Becket's blood both spilled and collected, there are even stories of the blood replenishing itself from only a few dry scrapings. The monks in the body's charge knew that ultimately the supply was limited. They smartly began carefully including only a dot or so of the precious blood, mixed with some water into tiny metal bottles called ampulla. Many of these were meticulously made with scenes of the soon-to-be new saint featured upon them. The blessed fluid therein became known as St. Thomas's water. There are no figures given or any true way to know just how many people drank Thomas Becket's blood, certainly hundreds, possibly thousands, and it was the first and only time the ingesting of a saint's actual blood was sanctioned by the church. And now, dear guests, we have just for you, just for tonight, a little parting gift made in the likeness of the wee bottles that held the old saint's blood. These vampy little vials with inlaid images of Mr. Darling and myself contain only tap water from the Midnight Library, but it's the thought that counts, right? And we think that if you are tempted to drink from our fiendish little flasks, that you should probably do so at least 20 miles from, well, everywhere. Let me wish you good night and good luck. Good night, my dear guests.
Madam? Madam, where have you disappeared to?
Shh! I'm up here.
Why are you hanging around outside the Count's guest room? Oh, you have a crush on him.
Shh! I'm looking for something.
Your dignity, perhaps.
Excuse me. Do I question you about your trips to town to hang around in the butcher's wife's garden?
No, but apparently you do follow me. Now, for goodness sake, woman, take that high lace collar off and show a little artery action, or you'll never catch the Count's eye.
Thank you, Mr. Darling.
Good luck, madam.
The Midnight Library is proudly brought to you by me, Miranda Merrick, and Astonishing Legends. The excellent sound design is by Chris at Sounds Like an Earful. We are kindly sponsored by our spooky, lovely patrons. If you would like to do as they've done and step beyond the cordoned off areas, visit patreon.com/midnightlibrary. Join our Patreon and you'll hear directly from me. Just make sure your notifications are on. Find us in your local cemetery and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our bizarre merch can be found at redbubble.com/people/midnightlibrary.